Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It is Friday. It's the 23rd of September, and it is very nice to have you with us this morning. We have a lot to talk about, as we always do. It seems like I always say that, but it seems always true. There's always a lot going on in the world, and we have a lot to attend to this morning, so we will do just that. Let me introduce our panel to you and then let you know how you can be in on our discussion. Roundtable at WAMC.org is the way, and we welcome Dr. Alan Shartok to the proceedings. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe, and I hope you're going to tell everybody the exciting news that up until the election, we'll be adding an extra half an hour. Won't that be great?
Yes, we're going to be 90 minutes for the panel, and that'll start on Monday morning. And this meaning Monday, what's the day? The 26th. Thank you, Rob. Thank you. 26th of September. And yeah, we'll go 90 minutes. So we have a lot to talk about. We'll be now Monday will be the run up to the debate. Tuesday, we'll have the debate coverage. And then there are going to be all the other debates. And then, of course, we'll have the fun drive in between there. So yeah, there's going to be a lot going on. But it'll be very exciting. And
we're really going to talk about the lockbox for an extra 15 minutes, right? Right?
No. Don't start that nonsense, Rosemary. I'll turn this car right around and go home.
No, it's good. I'm just looking at how much I have to study.
I'll know what you're looking for. You're looking for a fight, and you're not going to get one.
Oh, you are so easy to rile, Alan.
All right. Rosemary Armeo is here. She is the director of the journalism department at the University at Albany. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning, and I have to warn you, I'm walking out early today. I'm not even staying the whole hour, and that's because I want to talk to some Union College computer people about protecting reporter sources. Seems
that's
pretty
great.
Interesting. Yes.
Excellent. So we will. So the last segment, you will not be with us.
That's right.
Okay. So just remember, on Monday, it's going to be an hour and a half. So put that in your calendar.
I will. I'll be here Monday.
Okay. Barbara Smith will be with us for the entire time this morning, our entire hour. She is an author and an activist and a panelist on this program, and we're thrilled to have her. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank
All right.
You.
So we have a lot going on, so let us get to it and talk about what is happening in the news. And that begins with the continued presence of talking about what's happening with the police and in our communities, and specifically the latest here has to do with the question of whether a video should be released. This is in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the video has been seen by the family, but is not apparently going to be released. Does anyone, Rosemary, I'm counting on you on this, but I don't know if mm-hmm. this if you know this fully or not, but What is the protocol for the release of such footage?
It's by local rule and practice. And in North Carolina, in Charlotte, that is a longtime practice of theirs that they won't release it until A, the investigation is over, or B, there is some compelling reason otherwise. And the police chief there said repeatedly he doesn't see that other reason. Apparently 3 days of riots and another dead protester was not reason enough. He did show it to the family and their lawyer.
And the family wishes it to be seen.
They want it to be. They urged it to be shown. There has been some, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, anyone on the panel, but from my understanding that there was, that the police have said that there was a gun present. The family says in that video that is not apparent. And
so did the police chief, I believe.
Yeah.
I think he
yes.
said that he,
police
you
chief can't
said he tell.
Can't.
But
he
the
can't
thing
say.
Is...
Right.
I'm so
right.
sorry.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if forensics, kinds of approaches to looking at video have happened yet, or if they're just looking at kind of the raw.
They looked at two views, two different views, and from that you can't see it. So
let me just set this up real quick. The grieving relatives of a man who was killed by the police in Charlotte, North Carolina, watched videos on Thursday of the fatal shooting, a wrenching experience that they said revealed no hint of aggression in him and left the family members convinced that the video should be made public. But the city's police chief, who had arranged the private viewing, held fast to his decision not to release those recordings. The wife and other relatives of the dead man, Keith Scott, watched his killing from two angles, recorded Tuesday by police dashboard and body cameras, and it was incredibly difficult, a family lawyer said in a statement. He said the family had come away with more questions than answers and a different interpretation from the account offered by the police, who have said that Mr. Scott was shot after he got out of his car brandishing a gun.
That's what I was going to ask Barbara about, and we kind of keep talking over each other. But I've read that the police have announced that they did find a gun, did not find a book. The family said he was just sitting in the car reading a book. But I've not heard a whole lot of it after that first announcement.
And that's what I've heard. I've heard what you've heard, Rosemary, but I think it's still kind of confusing. And the point I was trying to get to is, like, my understanding is that you can enhance videos and find things, you know, if you have that
not
level
in the
of technical,
raw mm-hmm.
yeah, that kind of technical expertise. So I don't know if that has been done with the videos, but as has been pointed out, North Carolina is an open carry state. Now, whether he was brandishing or not, that's another issue. But just having a gun in his possession,
right,
that was allowed.
That's not well. Yeah. And mm-hmm. here's another thing too. Tulsa, we have an unfortunately horrible similar accident. Tulsa immediately released the footage, which does not help the officer at
yes.
all. It supports the family, the survivors. And there has been peace there. It's been quiet there. And, of course, they also brought charges against the officer in a timely fashion.
I want to just read one paragraph and then go to Alan on this. During Wednesday night's demonstrations, a protester was shot in the head in what police described as a civilian-on-civilian episode, but some protesters accused the police of opening fire. Early Thursday evening, just about the time a crowd was gathering, the police announced that the man had died earlier in the day and that the department had begun a homicide investigation. Alan, your thoughts on all this?
Well, when you get those kinds of chaotic situations, bad things are going to happen. I mean, we know that. I wanted to rejoin the question. You know, I'm not very good at watching CNN and doing my work, but I was watching the other day, yesterday, I think, and they kept circling something on the ground. Rosemary and Barbara, do you remember know about this? And the implication was that that was the gun. And I don't know whether or not anything has come of that, because obviously, as you have both suggested, this is where forensics comes into play. Whether somebody has a fingerprint on the gun, whether this is, I hate to say this, but it has not been unknown in the past for police to play a game called dropsy.
Yep.
So that when there's a question of a gun, whether they had one or not, somebody drops a gun into the mix.
Well,
so that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and to Barbara's point, it is an open carry state, so there is still the difference of having a gun present versus brandishing a gun and finding that to be a threatening act to the police officers, correct?
Correct.
Right.
And
yeah, but Joe, go ahead. I'm sorry, Barbara. Go ahead.
I was just going to say what you saw on CNN that was circled. That, to my understanding, that's what the police chief and others can't figure out what it is just looking at it. So the fact that CNN put a circle around something that was on the ground, is that correct, Alan? That's where it was?
Yes.
The object
was
on the ground. My understanding is that them looking at it and looking at it not through a TV screen or whatever, but actually looking at the footage itself, that they said it was not definitive.
You know, that whole confusion to me weakens their argument that they can't release the video yet. Release the video, then do your enhancing, do your investigating. If no one can tell, if the family and the chief disagree, so will members of the public. So show it.
The
right.
One of the most fiery and impressive speakers of the Democratic National Convention on the final night of the convention was a man by the name of William Barber, Dr. William Barber, who is a president of the North Carolina NAACP. He spoke yesterday on this issue and said there must be transparency and the video must be released. He said the protesters who had taken to the streets by the hundreds were rising up against systems of injustice that protect officers who kill. He made it very clear in his statement, saying it's about saying we are against bad police because bad police make it bad for good police. It's not about black people hating police.
Right. And as you know, you interviewed Reverend Barber
when he was here
earlier,
in town, yes.
This year, and I got the opportunity to see him speak at Siena. And even before that, he is widely regarded as one of the most dynamic newer civil rights leaders that we have, because he's a person who started the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina around all the egregious legislation, primarily the legislation and governor's edicts coming out of their state government. But anyway.
And a lot on voter as far as.
Oh, yeah. Many different things.
Yes.
I mean, they, they spoke the right out about the transgender bathroom.
Yes.
I'll put that in quotes because it really isn't about transgender bathrooms. It's about transgender rights. But the thing is that they did speak out. That's the beauty of the Moral Monday movement. They speak out for justice generally. Now, this thing about whether black people hate police, and that was the last part of the quote, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's, I don't even want to get into that, but I guess I want to go to that Congress member. Where was the Congress member from who said that the reason that black people do hate white people in general is because white people are successful and black people aren't? And then this person who is a...
Kansas.
Okay. And then yes. My home state, Ohio, this person who is a Republican, active member of the Republican party there, she said that if black people haven't been successful in the last 50 years, that there's something wrong with them. And then she also said there was no racism before Obama office. So there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of confusion. But you have to raise the question, how should one logically feel about a group, an organization that on a regular basis dispatches people in your community who are unarmed and without cause? How should you feel about them? Now, I'm not saying how I feel. I'm just saying, like, how would a large group of people feel if this kind of thing kept happening?
The woman you quoted in Ohio, by the way, is the head of the Trump campaign there. And Mr. Trump has said what he would do. He would allow police, he would change the rules of operation to allow stop and frisk.
Oh, yeah.
So that would take care of it, in his view.
After it has been declared unconstitutional.
Correct. I think, however, that there are some steps that can be taken and that blacks and whites should be lobbying for strongly. One is better recruiting and training, money to pay for it, monitoring of mental health in police officers and treatment if they need it or get them out. The woman in Tulsa who was accused of manslaughter now was afraid for her life. We have she was alone. She's got a black man who is backing away from her, not coming towards her, not brandishing anything, and she is afraid for his life. That's why she's charged with manslaughter, not murder. Why is she a cop? Because you're going to be alone with single drivers all the time if you're a police officer. So there's lots wrong with police, and you can be supportive of police and still call for massive reforms which are needed.
So we're going to
and one last question, and that is, if it goes to a jury trial, which it probably will a jury convict a police officer ever?
I don't see it.
That's a great,
I see her getting off.
Great question.
I see her getting off just as the Freddie Gray was murdered in a vehicle that was filled with police officers. Five were targeted for prosecution, and all of them got off.
Some say, though, in that particular case, and I know this is a larger discussion for another, that they were overcharged.
The prosecutors went for huge charges. Okay, so in Tulsa, they went for manslaughter. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I suspect what's really going to make a difference is the kind of massive look at the whole department that the Justice Department under Obama has begun in Baltimore and Ferguson and places similar.
Alan, we have a few minutes before we go to our break, so let's go to some letters before we do that.
Okay. Joseph says, kudos, Alan. I'd love to see the fingerprints they take from the bullet casing inside the gun of the victim in Charlotte, because if it was actually belonged to the dead father, don't you see? His prints would be left all over those bullets as he loaded them into said gun. You know, I think we have to be very careful about confusing, because I know I'm not talking to Joe about this, not you, Joe, but Joe who wrote the letter, because sometimes I'm beginning to confuse these two cases. And it's not easy, but dropsy is something that we have seen in the past. Lisa says these videos are paid for by taxpayers and are owned by the public. This was stated by William Barber on Democracy Now! This morning. Not releasing the video is the opposite of transparency. Obviously, there is something to hide. Also, North Carolina has open carry laws, and this includes African-American citizens. Yep. The civilian killed during the protest was harmed by a police tear gas canister, which caused him to fall and hit his head, said Lisa. Let's see here. John says, I think it is also the case that the man was waiting for his son's school bus, gun or no. Just think, what father waiting for his son would think I'm going to pull a gun on these cops? John from Troy. And Richard says, love the 90-minute panel. Good morning, panel. I've never written in before, but I love the fact you're going to do 90-minute panels until the election. I love the conversations every morning. Keep up the witty banter and commentary, and absolutely keep talking about the election. No matter what the detractors say, people need to understand how important this election is. Thanks, and that's from Rich. You tell me when to stop, Joe, when you need
it. Go one more, and I think we'll be good. Maybe two.
Okay. And Edward says, the SUNY board has legal responsibility to oversee SUNY Poly and employees like Calieros. They either were asleep at the switch or given some incentive not to look too closely. And there's that. And, you know, there is an interesting thing here. The legislature, in its great wisdom, decided not to let the excellent controller of the state of New York, who does great audits, do, as I understand it, audit the Calieros operation. Am I wrong about that?
Nope.
Did anybody else see that?
No, you're right.
Oh, okay. That's that ain't good, as my son Jonas would say. That ain't good, Dad.
One more letter and then we'll take a break.
Okay. James writes, don't you think the governor would be intensely angry that his close confidant violated his own trust rather than the public's trust, as he states? Makes one wonder if the governor knew about these ill doings. And that's from James.
All right, let's take a break. We will be back and we'll continue with more stories and listen more right after news from the BBC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel and our discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Barbara Smith, and Rosemary Armeo make up the panel this morning. And I want to get to Rosemary mentioned this, and I just want to make sure that we clarify this because there is the other story out of Tulsa, the white police officer who fatally shot an unarmed black driver. Last week, as he stood outside his vehicle, overreacted during a confrontation captured on video and was charged on Thursday with first-degree manslaughter, that according to court documents. The officer, Betty Jo Shelby, 42 years old, was overcome with fear that the man, Terrence Crutcher, 40 years old, who was not responding to her commands and was walking away from her with his hands up, was going to kill her. So that story goes on as well. And I just wanted to add that to the mix because, there's obviously the commonalities to these stories, but there are big differences as well.
Well, there's commonalities. I'm sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No. I just wanted to say that we got two interesting letters. One was from Jason, who I really think hits the nail on the head. I despise the racism in policing, but this is really the result of society creating the horrible inequality. I'm sorry. We can't use a blunt instrument like the police to cure a much deeper social problem, and until we fix the poverty and racism, the problems will never subside. And by the way, I think that hits the nail on the head. And then we also heard from John, who said, as the African-American on the panel, Barbara, do you think that all of these shootings are a new form of lynching? Do you hear other African-Americans voicing this view? Also, could you address the white speak that's always trotted out in reaction to these shootings? Barbara?
There have been parallels drawn between the era of lynching and the era of excessive police brutality. That's obvious in many ways. There's always been absolute obsession with policing black bodies in this nation, starting with the institution of enslavement. So yes, I would definitely draw parallels between the era of lynching, when mob violence and mob extrajudicial actions ended up with dead black people, and this era that we're in now. And I would say I would say from the mid-20th century until now, because the era of lynching by historians was generally said to have ended in the 1960s, which of course parallels the rise of the civil rights movement and civil rights protections. Right. So I would say from the mid-20th century until now, what we've been dealing with is excessive police brutality. And I did. I thought that letter, you know, that talked about the relationship of inequality and poverty to policing. That's. I don't know what your response is, Rosemary. I'd like to hear that. But there is a book that I highly recommend to people that I recently read, which is titled "From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation." It's written by, and you'll never get the name, and I'm going to spell it on the radio. Her name is Kianga Yamata Taylor. T-A-Y-L-O-R, and it's published by Haymarket Books. She's a professor at Princeton University, and it's a really interesting book. It's very leftist, so if you can't deal with, you know, those kinds of perspectives, so then
get ready.
Yeah, then just leave it on the shelf. But she does a really interesting analysis of, like, how police are expected to police people who are living in poverty, and policing and the prison industrial complex also creates poverty. Yeah. So it's a really interesting.
The statement I was going to make was not that I disagree with any of this. I think there's huge problems with that. I think Barbara's right on the history. However, these deaths are happening at traffic stops. We're not in the middle of dangerous situations. It's not, you know, have versus have not. It's people stopped for a headlight out, for weaving in traffic, for minor things. I don't get where all this big history stuff comes in. Just do your job.
I think the point is, like, if you look at Ferguson, for example, and then we found out that this was much more widespread, that people living in poor communities of color are over-policed often to help with the bottom line of the municipality.
Right.
So you're talking about traffic stops,
sure,
and broken taillights. Those are really great reasons to stop people, write tickets, and then, you know, thrust people into incarceration sometimes when they can't pay for those tickets and fines.
Yeah, but if you kill them, you don't get the money either, Barbara.
Yeah. Well, yes.
And there's
that.
And on that... And on that issue, we've heard from Kimberly, who says, I'm an African-American woman who has had to raise my sons, telling them, when you interact with the police, just say, yes, officer, memorize their badge number, and get out of there alive, because the only ones who can kill you and not have to answer for it. With all of that's been going on in the last few years in the history of violence from the state against black people, it is amazing that black people have not resorted to violence against police en masse. White people are always afraid that we will retaliate against them when one thing we want is not to be murdered for being black. That's from Kimberly. And then we heard from Michael, who said, hi, would it be accurate to say that based on the indictments, Dr. K... Oh, no, that's a different one. I'm sorry.
Okay, yep.
Okay, Michael says, is it relevant here that the cop shooter was black? Nobody has mentioned this. Can a black cop have racist feelings towards black citizens? Well, Michael, I have to warn you, as I have warned so many people, and Rosemary and I were just talking about that on the Media Project yesterday when we taped it, which is, we hear from all these people who say, nobody has mentioned it. Well, I knew it. You knew it. Somehow we got the information. Did we get it from osmosis floating through the air, or has it been mentioned? The answer is we all got it from the news, and you know it. Sorry.
And Barbara, your thoughts on that, actual point?
Well, I think as people who really have a good analysis of what's wrong with policing in the United States, they do talk about how it's the institution. It's how the institution is conceived of and defined and practiced, not necessarily the actors or the players. That once you have a trajectory of very negative relationships with people who are viewed to be disproportionately criminal and more dangerous, that yes, indeed, this is where implicit bias comes in, that yes, indeed, an officer who is himself a person of color might indeed react very similarly to his white his or her white counterpart. So that's why, as I said, you have to look at so many different factors, like dealing with implicit bias. The Albany Police Department, every person in that department, whether they are a sworn officer or a civilian employee, every Albany Police Department employee has had during this year training in implicit bias. So that's a very positive thing.
I do want to get back to what Alan was saying, because it's a really good point of this idea that people say that it's never being talked about, and yet they know about it. And it seems that are the things that we conveniently forget, Alan, sometimes, do you think? Because this seemed to have been reported, of the race of the officer.
Oh, no, it was reported, it was viewed, no question about it. We all knew about it. The only thing I say is when I hear from people that nobody, and Rosemary and I were just talking about this, that nobody has mentioned this, it's just nonsense. That's all. I think people really ought to think about it a second before they overindulge in the rhetoric.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversations. We have other topics. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Sunwood Builders Amherst. Over 20 years of green and custom home building, offering home remodeling services and energy retrofits, working to save energy while maintaining design features. Sunwood-Builders.com. The Montessori School of the Berkshires, Lenoxdale, Massachusetts, dedicated to engaging the natural curiosity of children, toddler through 8th grade. Weekday tours available, berkshiremontessori.org. And George Heigl Cowan's Representative, available for estate, trust, and full collection evaluations and consultations in the Capital Region, 518-396-7974.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. During the break, Rosemary left, so she had an appointment. So that leaves Alan.
Oh boy!
So Alan Chartok and Barbara Smith on the panel. We have topics. I want to get to Donald Trump on the campaign trail, and we'll of course have more letters in just a moment. Donald Trump has
I sure hope we're going to talk about what Preet Bharara did yesterday.
Absolutely,
that is so important. Yeah.
Absolutely, Donald Trump has amplified his focus this week on a strident nationalist and law and order message, emphasizing rhetoric that has fueled his popularity among white working class voters, but with which also threatens to antagonize the centrists likely to decide the November election. This from the Washington Post. In speeches and interviews in recent days, Trump has called for, quote, American hands to remake the country rather than those of foreigners. He has portrayed Syrian refugees as a cultural threat, not just a security risk. He has also embraced controversial stop and frisk policing, a tactic championed by some conservatives, but also opposed to minority communities as a form of racial profiling, and suggested on Thursday that drugs were a major factor in anti-police protests. Trump's hard-edged message is at odds with more traditional nominees who tend to use the final weeks of the race to shore up support among voters in the middle of the political spectrum. So, Alan, we'll go to you first on this, and then I know Barbara has some thoughts as well.
Well, thank God Barbara's here, because, you know, she is really an important voice in this discussion. But I have to say, I've been saying all along that in the beginning it was sort of hidden, but now it's right out there. The way that Trump people think that they can win this election is to mobilize white middle-class voters. Let's keep those people, those black people, those Hispanic people, and all of the people who want to come into this country, the Syrians and anybody else, down. It's that simple. Are there enough white voters who will come out, they're saying, I suspect, who will come out and vote so that it becomes a black-white issue? I hate it, but I think that's exactly what they're up to. That's where I am.
Barbara?
Well, I think the whole campaign has been so mired in the most backwards, antediluvian, racial, xenophobic sexist, misogynistic attitudes, making fun of people with disabilities. It's a hate campaign. Make America
hate.
Yeah,
but Barbara.
Yes.
But Barbara, don't you think that it is becoming, I agree with you. I mean, I've said it from the very beginning, but I think it was much more muted in the beginning.
Yes,
back and
absolutely.
Forth.
I would agree.
But now it's right out there.
It's
they
totally
think it's working
there.
And they're going to do it more and they're going to do it more.
I totally agree. It's totally out there. But the reason I mentioned where it began and where, and I agree, it's much more intense now as the election looms so closely. But I guess what the point I would like to make is that many people in this nation go out of their way not to see what's going on around this kind of racism and bigotry. And you're absolutely stating it. But even yesterday here on the roundtable, Rich Honan, if I heard correctly, said that he did not think that Donald Trump was promoting racism and Islamophobia. And it's just like, what? It doesn't make any sense. It's like, why would you even pretend that that's not what's happening? And it's despicable. And I think there's a lot of as the days get closer and closer to that election, to this election, there's more and more, I think, anxiety about the horrible what if.
You know, Barbara, one of the reasons I love having Rich Honan on the program, and would like to have him more, to be perfectly honest with you, is that that he is not a bird crying in the wilderness. This is a guy who represents, in what he says there, about half of America. Take a look at the polls. There are polls out this morning that shows Donald Trump is going to win this election using this particular idea that I'll go to a black church, I'll pretend I'm not racist, but in fact, I'll continue to do the kinds of things which are going to incite this sort of white-black morass that we have. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and it's so insane that, a triumph of the criminal justice system, the process, was that stop and frisk was declared unconstitutional. That's a triumph. And, of course, he goes against it. We should bring it back. And, of course, Rudy Giuliani, I'm sure, is saying the same thing. It just makes no sense whatsoever. And there's a point I wanted to make over and above stop and frisk, but it's a concept that black people today are living in the worst circumstances that they've ever lived
right.
in. Have you ever heard of slavery?
Right.
I mean, it's just so appalling. I mean, the age of lynching was
before the civil rights movement, even.
Yes, exactly. It's like to pretend that you're worse off now than you've ever been, and I can be the person. What do you got to lose? I'd say everything. But the thing is that he is just so benighted, and he can't hold two concepts in his mind at one time. There are black people who have become prosperous, who are well-educated, who have stable homes and economic lives, who are doing pretty much what every person is doing, who's just doing their day-to-day as hardworking Americans. There are a lot of us like that. At the very same time, we have disproportionate poverty, and we have poverty that's connected to racism and racial oppression. We can hold those concepts in our minds at the same time. But he can't.
Yep. No, he can, Barbara. I'm so sorry. I disagree with you. He can. He knows what he's doing. He's not a buffoon. He's got half the people in the country voting for him. He knows what he's doing. It's not that he can't keep these concepts straight in his mind. It's that he doesn't want to.
Oh.
It's that it doesn't help him in what he's doing. Hey, Joe, are we going to talk about you know what?
Yeah. I was just waiting for you to finish. Do you mean you know what, meaning Governor Cuomo?
There's this huge story yesterday in which
Barrara. Now hold on.
Yeah.
So I'll do that.
Yeah.
But we did talk about this yesterday, but so the part I want to get to today is that there's an article in the Times that says Cuomo's silver lining in the new Albany graft case is that no sign he did wrong. So
well. If something really bad happened at WAMC, who do you think would be held responsible? Me, that's who. I mean, the guy was the head of the government. These were his two closest friends. One has to suspend, judgment because it's not fair. You can't say that you know what you don't know. But in any case, he's the head of the administration. And as a result of that, he has to be held responsible for what his agents were doing. And whether he knew about it or not is one thing. But if he didn't know about it, why didn't he know about it?
Okay, so absolutely. So the question that comes in here is one that is brought out in this article in the New York Times, which says that throughout the Preet Bharara report that the governor makes only cameo appearances in the complaint. So if what you say, which I agree with, what you say is true, then why are they just cameo appearances? Chris Churchill had a line in his article this morning in the Times Union that said that while no charges were filed against the governor, there's still an awful lot of lint on his black pants.
Yeah. You know, this is a heck of a story. I mean, you know, they have a cooperating witness. In other words, somebody has pleaded guilty, I think, to 8 charges in this, and he's going to throw everybody else under the bus. Now, of course, he's had a bit of a checkered career himself, and one wonders why he was so close to the governor if he had that kind of checkered career, if there were, you know, former judgments against him and other things. But he's there. He's going to be a hell of a witness because he's one of the guys who played the game. Unbelievable.
I do want to read one more paragraph of this article, Alan. Though rarely mentioned in the federal complaint, Mr. Cuomo hovers in the background of the narrative of his former aide's misdeeds and some of the more embarrassing revelations. Proximity to the governor and the executive chamber were the currency in which both Mr. Howe and Mr. Prococo traded, often by invoking Mr. Cuomo's name or exploiting his presence.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. You know, we see that all the time. When Eisenhower, that's how old I am, was president.
Me too.
One of the things his staff. Yeah. One of the things his
staff. I wasn't
voting
was
alleged
then, though.
To have. One of the things his staff was alleged to do, you had all these conflicts. One was saying, the president wants you to do this. And somebody else would say, no, the president wants you to do that. Now, these people, Don Regan, remember Nancy Reagan didn't like Don Regan that much. But Don Regan was invoking the power of the presidency also. And I think it's one of the things that, or the president's reputation, I think it's one of the things that got him into so much trouble. How about the Watergate guys, all of those Watergate people?
It is.
So, yeah.
Well, it is confusing. Right. There were two things yesterday. And one was the federal charges that came out from Preet Bharara's office. Later in the day, there were also charges that came out from the New York State Attorney General's office. So there are two separate investigations
right.
and two separate charges. On the second, I do have to recuse myself on that because of my wife's position with one of the agencies that is tangentially involved with what is going on there. But it is interesting that you sort of have this double whammy and what appears at least to be kind of a fight to the finish line as to who could get the charges out first.
Well, I think on the contrary, I think they probably were cooperating, Joe. I don't have any line in there, I'll tell you right now. I have great admiration for the U.S. attorney, and I think that this is, I think this is very interesting. Remember, this is a governor who has not treated his attorney general well from the beginning. And you may remember the Moreland Act Commission. Hello, everybody. Remember the Moreland Act Commission? Well, he had to get A.G. Schneiderman to come in to deputize all the people on the commission so they could go, what I would characterize as, go after the legislature. And then the governor, I don't think Schneiderman had anything to do with this, unilaterally ended up the Moreland Act Commission and left Schneiderman with his hands in his pockets. I don't think this is the kind of thing that is very nice. I have a feeling Schneiderman, this could be a very interesting psychodynamic here if one is following my reasoning. I think they cooperated. I think they had a decision. We're going to do it on the same day. The guy who is really, you know, should be upset by this is Calieros. He got not only the federal charges. This was Mr. Untouchable in state government. Trust me, I know this. And he was Mr. Untouchable, paid more money than anybody else in state government. And now he has to face it both in the afternoon and in the morning from the U.S. attorney. Well, from Preet. Unbelievable.
So the question now, of course, is where this leaves SUNY Poly, which there have been great tensions between the university system as a whole and this separate entity. We only have about a minute left, Alan. But now Elaine Calieros has been put on leave.
Unpaid.
Are you sure?
Yes.
That's what they said.
I read in the paper yesterday. Paid.
No.
What, Barbara?
Without
pay. I've heard unpaid.
He will not be paid.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, he has enough. One of his sports cars could pay him for a year.
Okay. We're out of time. But my point was that you look at that and you say, okay, but now how do we move on? Because obviously these entities still have to run in the meantime.
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough because he was very good at it. That's the thing. He was very good at it. He was making all that money. And still, he was cooperating with the governor's people. I'm not saying the governor, with the governor's people. I wonder why.
All right, we're going to end there. A reminder, we're going to go another half hour beginning Monday. We'll go 90 minutes and through the election, and we want to remind you of that. So be with us on Monday morning, and of course we'll have the debate to talk about, and the day before the debate, and of course after the debate, and all the other debates, all good stuff. Barbara Smith, Rosemary Arameo, and Alan Chartok, have a great weekend. Thank you.